You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
In the middle of the 20th century, a process of collection started, one that would profoundly shape biblical studies for decades to come, all the way to our own moment. To say more than that would probably run afoul of any number of chapters of Andrew Perrin's book, Lost Words and Forgotten Worlds, Rediscovering the Dead Sea Scrolls, from Lexham Press, so I'll try not to overstep too early in the episode. Instead, I'll say that his book stands both as an introduction to this fascinating collection and its place in our knowledge of biblical cultures, and that for someone like me who studied Qumran back when Bill Clinton was still president, the book provides some interesting new questions to pose as we think about the Dead Sea Scrolls. Andrew, thank you for joining us on the show.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
I want to start not with the very beginning of the book, but something that you write relatively early, namely that most of the Dead Sea Scrolls were not excavated, but they were looted. Is the main difference between those two a legal distinction, an ethical distinction, a procedural distinction, some mix of those? And why is that distinction important for this book?
Yeah, great question, and good to kind of dive into an exciting area and challenging one right off the hop. So I think the point I'm making there and can kind of expand on here is less about them being looted per se and more about the long legacy of questions that maybe we haven't asked about their origins or acquisitions and chain of custody and their movement even. And those are things I think we're starting to ask a lot more questions about, which is very important. Because if we think to the probably common story of how the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, which maybe folks are familiar with, it's a, you know, a young shepherd boy, he throws a stone, he hears a clink, he climbs into a cave, and there's scrolls. That's almost more of a modern tale than it is the actual details of discovery, at least, or maybe it's part of a story. Because the reality is, most of the Dead Sea Scrolls were not found in situ. That means they weren't found in a controlled, supervised archaeological dig. So that means we should be trying to pay a lot more attention to the process from how they came from caves until they arrived in hands in museums, universities, collections, all these things. And so your question, is it legal, ethical, procedure, mix? All of the above. That's secret answer D on the multiple choice test, right? Like, it's all of the above because things changed so much in this last 7-8 decades since the discovery. Things like borders change. There's the Six-Day War in 1967. That's really important for part of the scroll story. International policy on antiquities trading changes. There's a 1970 UNESCO convention that prohibits movement of items of cultural heritage. All of these things are part of our world that have to do with legal, ethical, procedural, all of those things, all of the above, that now as scholars, students, readers of the scrolls and other artifacts, we're asking, is the story as simple as a stone, a cave, scrolls, and we're done? Or is there a lot more we should be thinking about here that's not only about their ancient context, but our modern relationship to these artifacts? So that's kind of one of the areas I try to unpack, or at least invite readers into in the book, because that's not something you'll find in other Dead Sea Scrolls books before this.
Very good. And listeners, hopefully that opening conversation gave you some sense of the complexity of the investigations in this book. I appreciate that complexity because, Andrew, as you know, you didn't write this book for biblical scholars, but you still want to leave readers with, quote, complex, better, and new questions, end quote. So do you see our moment as we talk today as an especially important moment for those kinds of questions concerning Qumran, or did this book mainly arise for you as a scholar because you became capable of articulating these questions? Is this a book for a moment, or is this a book you recently became capable of? Or again, some mix.
I think it's a book that was born out of kind of a moment that I first had with the scrolls, but then took decades to kind of come to a moment that felt like that from the other side of the kind of lecture hall podium, if you will, because I first encountered the scrolls as an undergrad theology student. I had no idea what they were, and I was fortunate enough to have teachers that kind of brought me into that world and helped me learn and explore and be curious. And that's, you know, going through a few university degrees and research and writing and publishing and all of that. But it was that initial spark that I had, you know, that there's something here in the scrolls. It's very exciting, but there's also generally quite a high barrier to get into these texts. They're written in Hebrew and Aramaic and Greek. Even looking them up in a textbook, even knowing which book to look them up in, is quite confusing. Before you even read the text, there's about 18 different hurdles you have to jump. And I really found that in my teaching in the scrolls over the years, students were not always, but often coming with some curiosity, like I had as an undergrad student. But what they needed was an invitation. They didn't need someone to say, here's 18 different books, here's all the details you need about everything. They needed someone to say, here's kind of the lay of the land, here's an invitation to the space, and why don't we walk through it together? We're not going to get at everything, but we'll get at some things that are interesting, challenging, and meaningful. So it's kind of that both end, but it really reflects a little bit of my own journey, and then trying to be generous with myself as a scholar and a writer to be inviting folks into that space still. So it's meant to be that invitation, but it's one that I probably couldn't have written without having had some time to live and think and work on the scrolls for a few decades now.
That's good. And this is one of those books that as I was reading it, I thought, yeah, I'm probably going to hand this to my son. He's about to start his third year in college, because it really does introduce a lot of the questions, like I said, and like you said, surrounding biblical studies that you don't always get, from sort of popular discussions of the same.
Yeah. Yeah, I tried to hit that space kind of in between. It's not popular, but it's also not something you'll get at an academic conference. Like it's kind of that missing link, which I think is really important.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, let's dive into the book's chapters. The first full chapter highlights the upheavals that careful study reveal in the world of scriptural devotion in Roman-occupied Judea. So talk to our listeners a little bit about the cross-section of the library that was found in Cave 1 and how attending to that diversity leads us to some of these questions that your introduction promises.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I was talking a minute ago about, it's hard to know where to start. I even feel like that as a scholar of the scrolls. You have about 930 manuscripts, most of them incredibly fragmentary. So where do you go if you're going to just start reading the scrolls? You could start anywhere and you could have a choose your own adventure, and that's great. That'd be fun. But the approach I took here was, what if we tried to paint in broad strokes and then fill in the details later? And when we do that, Cave 1 is a very interesting place to start. So there's 11 caves where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. There's been some ongoing debate and discoveries, but for the most part, they're discovered first starting in 1947 into the early mid-50s with 11 caves. And that first cave initially had 7 texts that were discovered. Now, those 7 texts, generally, if you look at them and then you look at the 930 texts that were eventually discovered, they more or less capture the types of writings that were found in the larger collection. So I'll test my own memory here. You have the community rule, which is a sectarian document where it's outlining the community of Qumran, the scribal community that copied and collected the scrolls, their hopes, their expectations, their community structures, all of these things. Then we have 2 scrolls of Isaiah, 1 Q Isaiah A and 1 Q Isaiah B. Big part of the Dead Sea Scrolls are earliest copies of many writings and traditions that eventually we have in Hebrew Bible and Old Testament, with Isaiah being 2 examples of that already in Cave 1. So that's very important among the scrolls. Then there was, 1, 2, 3, the 4th would be the War Scroll. The War Scroll is a Hebrew text where this community is envisaging the end of all things, where God will right all wrongs, and they are on the right side of human history. They understood themselves as the sons of light versus the sons of darkness, and guess what? If you weren't in the sons of light in the community, then you were on the other side of the equation. And so the War Scroll is really unpacking that expectation of how things will end as far as they were concerned. Then we have things like the Hodayot. The Hodayot is also known as the Thanksgiving Scroll. It's a scroll, we eventually have more copies of this text, that are hymns that seem to be written by or remembering their teacher of righteousness. And this is that founding figure for this community that inspired their liturgical imagination, their scriptural interpretation, and all of these things. It's a beautiful text to read. Then we have something called Pesher Habakkuk. Now, unlike the Isaiah scrolls, this is not a copy, for example, of the book of Habakkuk. Rather, it's a pesher, and that's an interpretive genre. This is an interpretive text that quotes and comments on the book of Habakkuk, Only it's doing so from the perspective that this community has the right interpretation of that text because they have this teacher of righteousness who had this inspired revelation. Now, all of those six texts, I think if I'm counting correctly, are all written in Hebrew. That in and of itself is really important. The last text I'll touch on is written in Aramaic, and that's called the Genesis Apocryphon. Now, the Genesis Apocryphon is almost like a retelling of parts of the book of Genesis. And it's like any remade movie today, right? You go see a movie that you maybe is a remake from something 20 years ago. It's going to have the same characters, the general same plot line, but different turns and twists and a contemporary take on things. Genesis Apocryphon is kind of like an Aramaic remake of elements of the Hebrew Genesis. Now, when you look at those seven texts, there's so much going on in there. And that generally reflects the things that we see in the broader manuscripts that are found in those 11 caves. What we don't get in those first seven is there are Greek texts also found at Qumran, some of them. So that would be kind of one exception to the rule and some others. But what I like about doing that is it really does two things for your first introduction to the scrolls. It makes it less daunting because I'm not saying here's a 930 manuscripts, go read it and have fun. It's saying here's seven that will get you started and get you a pretty good grasp on things. Second, it gives us that snapshot. It gives you a sense of, okay, here's the larger landscape you're moving into. And then together, those two things give us a sense of not only the texts, but that all even more important recognition that all of these texts have a context. And that's the other big thing about the Dead Sea Scrolls that I'm really kind of unpacking throughout, you know, the second half of the book or throughout as well.
Now, within the scrolls, or I mean, from other evidence that's available to us, how strong a distinction or how blurry a distinction was there between what we would consider canonical texts and then the ones in that collection that in 2025 Christian and Jewish communities don't hold up as canon?
Yes. Yeah, really important question. The scrolls are coming from a world that's very different from our own in many ways, but a few key ways that relate to this question. The first is just by technology. They're pre-codex. The codex, a book, you know, eventually the Bible is a codex, right? And this is kind of where that comes from. The codex didn't exist yet. So already we're in a world of scrolls, not books. The second piece is they're also before the canon. So they're not only pre-codex, they're pre-canon. The canonization of the Hebrew Bible and then Christian scriptures, that's a longer process that is starting to kind of percolate in this period, but it's not fully that conversation is not fully happening. The third piece is, you know, you and I, and I'm assuming every listener, if they're alive today, is living in a post-printing press world. So when we see books, you know, if I buy a book and you buy a book, even if you're thousands of miles away, it's going to be the same publisher, the same words on the page. Everything will be the exact same. That's not the same case in an ancient scribal culture. So all of those are factors to be thinking about here. But to get directly to your question, many of the writings that we have in the Old Testament and Hebrew Bible today, many of them were circulating and read as authoritative, it seems like, in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Like we were talking about Pesher Habakkuk a minute ago. You probably aren't going to comment and have a big detailed commentary on Habakkuk if you didn't think it was an authoritative book. Same thing for Aramaic Genesis Apocryphon. You're not going to spend all that time and energy rewriting, reimagining, and interpreting Genesis in this incredible new way if you don't think Genesis is also authoritative.
And so we're in a world of technological moment where writing materials are very expensive.
Yeah, of course. That's just it, right? Like we're, you know, it's not only the outcome, it's the activity of doing that is a signal of some authority. Now, having said that, there are other writings that were also authoritative that are beyond what we would see as or canonical in for different traditions. So some of those include things that are in apocryphal books that are authoritative for some Christians, or even for things like Enoch for Orthodox Eastern or Ethiopian Orthodox Christians. So we have this kind of broader range of texts. Many of them are familiar from the Old Testament Hebrew Bible, but many of them are also in other collections that seem to have had different kind of legacies down through Judaism and Christianity.
Very good, very good. One line of questions that I didn't anticipate in sort of a general introduction to the Skrulls has to do with the Orientalism that lurks in some of the standard narratives. We already mentioned the boy in the cave. But for our listeners who are not as familiar with Edward Said, what is Orientalism, and why do we do well to watch out for Orientalism in these matters?
Yes, yeah. This is a term that might be probably new to a lot of folks, but once we describe it, you go, oh, I've seen that, or I've sensed that, or I've thought like that. So it's one of those things we're kind of putting a name to. A part of my book is not only to say, here's ancient texts, it's also to ask, how do we relate to them? And that, I think, is a very interesting question, because the scrolls are often presented as a lens into the ancient world, because they are. But arguably, they also help us put a mirror back to ourselves to say, why do we think this way? What is we're expecting? And are those things totally valid all the time? And Orientalism is one of those. So yeah, 1978, I believe, was Edward Said's book, Orientalism, same title. Fantastic book, very influential. Basically, he unpacks this idea that Western culture has really spun up and romanticized a very risky view, an inaccurate or even caricatured colonial view of what lifetimes and misadventures would have looked like in places like North Africa, the Middle East, and Asia. Now, I was a kid of the 80s, so if you think about like Indiana Jones movies in the 80s, like that's the pick. That is Orientalism right there. I'm not, you know, not to go too hard on Indy, but it's a Western imagination of what those places would have looked like and why they looked like that. That doesn't actually match what reality would have been. Now, so those images, whether we think about them or not, are particularly strong, they're deep-rooted, and they're very long-lasting. So when it comes to ancient manuscripts, even archaeological items, artifacts beyond the scrolls, not just the scrolls, this quite often can creep in. So one of the places we see this is in many versions, or some early versions, of the discovery story of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Like we said, there's more to the story than a boy, a stone, a clink in a cave. But there's often elements that draw the early discoverers, who were Bedouin tribes folk, as, you know, really like superstitious Muslims who were thieves, they were brigands, they didn't know better. And then surprise, surprise, a bunch of white guys show up kind of in Land Rovers and they rescue these texts that were almost lost. That is, you know, the scrolls are often said, oh, it's kind of like Indiana Jones-esque. Yeah, but also not for a good reason. It's because of Orientalism that's why people make that connection. That's why I'm kind of tongue-in-cheek saying, go watch Indiana Jones, you get it. Now, this matters because, like I said, it's the scrolls, sure, they can provide a lens into the ancient world, but the second we look through it, we're also looking through it with our own eyes that are modern. So how is it we think about these ancient texts? Why are we so interested in them? When it comes to studying these artifacts, what are the assumptions we carry with it, cultural or cognitive or otherwise, and how do we just be aware of those things? So I'm not saying this is, you know, you can't read the scrolls without doing it poorly. No. This comes down to one simple thing, awareness. And if we're good readers, then we should always be aware of that. And this is an area where I feel like it's in scrolls studies hasn't fully come into the fore, so that when I came across Edward Said's work and I was working on this book, it helped me maybe put a bit of some language to the things I want to talk about, but he definitely goes into this in much more detail.
Very good, very good. Now, if I didn't expect Edward Said, I certainly didn't anticipate Hobby Lobby on my Dead Sea Scrolls bingo card. So I just got to remind myself that since I studied the scrolls in, actually, I think January 2000,
all right.
The world has gotten weird in new ways since then. So talk a little bit about some of the 21st century's particular players in the ill-gotten antiquities field.
Yeah, absolutely. And you might have stepped out of scrolls just when things were about to get really wild, because it was around that time. For better or worse,
the time that I decided I wasn't going to be a biblical studies professor, I was going to be an English professor. So
I think I did
right when things got really weird.
Yeah, no, I think that might have been a wise move. Things got really, really weird or interesting depending on who you talk to. So I'll get to the headline, then we'll work backwards, because what we're talking about here is the ongoing controversy around modern forgeries, as well as, you know, fiascos of antiquities trading. That was not a headline until relatively recently. Now, this all starts in the late 90s. Well, not all starts, but it seems to have a surge in the late 90s. And then by about 2002, there's a spike in this almost supply and demand market of buying, selling, and now we know creating Dead Sea Scrolls fragments for private collectors that are buying them thinking that they're authentic. So you asked about major players. There's many private collectors across the world for antiquities, and not all of them relate to scrolls, but some of them do. But the ones you probably heard about most in kind of your news feeds in the last 5-6 years would be Museum of the Bible, the Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, Azusa Pacific University, Lanier Theological Library. Those are all American organizations. And then the Skøyen Collection, which is Martin Skøyen's a private collector in Norway. So the Hobby Lobby hook is they're the main stakeholders behind Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C. Now, they've come into a lot of hot water in the last several years, not only for their scrolls fragments, but for other antiquities items. So, and you can Google all this. This is nothing secretive. It's all fully out there in news starting around 2020, I think. They've come into hot water because the scrolls fragments that they purchased, as well as it seems also many other of these collections, like definitely Skøyen is aware of this, the scholars working on that, but they're forged. So these are multi-million dollar souvenirs. They're not actual scroll fragments. So that's kind of one part of the issue, but arguably the bigger another part of the issue, particularly for Museum of the Bible, is they have a growing large collection of ancient artifacts and texts related in some way to biblical history. The questions that they've been coming under fire for are the processes of the acquisitions of those artifacts. A few years ago, headlines were, they had something to the tune of 5,500 objects coming into the U.S. via mixed means. This resulted in many of these in a lawsuit and a settlement with the Justice Department, resulting in like a $3 million fine. And they had to return 3,800 of those artifacts to Iraq because that's where they originally came from and then made their way into the U.S. by some very unclear and questionable means. Now, examples like that are really problematic. Obviously for, like we were saying earlier, legal, ethical, procedural, all of those things. Yes, all of the above, they're really problematic. But it also opens up conversations that we should have been asking. So now we know better. And by we, I mean anybody who's interested in ancient artifacts. When we have that interest in them, we also need to be thinking ethically. We can't just be saying if it's a discovery of biblical significance, then at all costs we will acquire it. There's a huge ethical dimension to be thinking about here. And that's, I think, again, a silver lining of this mess is that this helps us have that mirror and go, okay, why are we thinking about them in this way? When I was writing this chapter in the book, I did spend some time researching around antiquities trading, art trading, illicit art trade as well. And then surprise, surprise, you end up overlapping. And I read a couple of really interesting articles that look at those things and international drug trafficking, because they're all shades of the same thing. And one of the statistics, I'll get the numbers wrong, so I won't quote them, but one of the statements about statistics that really stuck with me, and this is an article maybe 10, 15 years ago, so relatively recent, was a legal scholar. She said that the money that is generated through antiquities and art trading globally is second only to that of cocaine trafficking. And I thought, wow, that is really interesting. There's big money in this.
So bigger than any opioid is antiquities dealing.
Yeah, this is what I mean. The date of that article might be, now that stat might need to be changed, frankly. I'm well beyond my...
Be close.
She was bundling, I think, antiquities and art and a few things to kind of make a quite potent point, I think. But even if the stats aside, the fact that those two things are even in the same ballpark is interesting to think about. So, a lot has changed in scroll studies, ancient studies broadly, and I think as organizations and scholars, there is an ethical dimension to be thinking about. Yeah, I might not be buying and selling these things, but I'm studying them, and how do you relate to manuscripts and text today really matters.
Oh, that's fascinating. Now, when we get to your fourth chapter, we're finally into some territory that I find familiar. So this is the plurality of Second Temple Judaism. That this is my territory. I like this. So talk to our listeners a little bit about Josephus's four philosophies and why more recent historians use different terminologies to categorize the Pharisees and the Sadducees and such. And while you're on your way, talk a little bit about which of these groups is most likely, most directly involved with the Qumran scrolls.
Of course. So if we read sources like Josephus, who's an ancient Jewish historian, or Philo of Alexandria, he's a Jewish philosopher, kind of exegete in Egypt. Pliny as well is another important source. And the New Testament is an important source because if you're familiar with the New Testament, Jesus is quite often rubbing shoulders and debating other Jewish, groups and religious leaders like Pharisees, Sadducees, and the like. So those are kind of the types of sources we have that are giving some insight into these groups, or as you mentioned, that Josephus calls four philosophies, the Sadducees, the Pharisees, the Essenes, and this fourth philosophy that Josephus has. The scrolls never speak of any of them specifically. One of the exciting things about the scrolls and frustrating things is they love code names. They'll refer to the seekers of smooth things or the shoddy wall builders. And those are kind of nudges to other Jewish groups. So we're always trying to read between the lines.
Almost Shakespearean, I'll go ahead and say.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Maybe we'll do an interdisciplinary Shakespeare and scrolls seminar or something. But that's part of the challenge is then who are they talking about? And you're kind of reading in between the lines. So at the same time, these are, alongside Josephus and Philo, very early sources in the New Testament, very early sources to give insight to these groups. One of the sources, modern scholarly sources that really changed my thinking on this, or challenged my thinking, I should say, is E.P. Sanders. He's famous for his book, books on Paul and Judaism, but he also has some great books. One called Jewish Practice and Belief, or something like this. Anyways, you'll find it that way. It was a fantastic book, and I remember he has one short section on this, and even a sentence. And he makes the point. He says, "Look, not everybody had to be a Pharisee or a Sadducee. Like it's not like today you had to be a card carrying member of this political party or that political party. No, like for the most part, people were just, here was this idea of common Judaism. Like, yeah, there were Pharisees and Sadducees, but they have this common heritage and not everybody had to be one. So right. I think there's a lot more
and
nuance.
That's actually an apt parallel because a lot of recent studies have said that as many as 70 to 80% of American voters, at least, are part of what they call the exhausted middle, who doesn't much like Democrats or Republicans very much.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is, you could take any modern analogy like this. It works. It could be political parties. It could be sports teams. I'm a playoff bandwagon fan for almost any team, but I really have my team. Does that mean, religious affiliation? Convenient categories, but as soon as you apply them to groups at any point in time, it almost never works. So the scrolls give us kind of, not, I don't want to say closer to the ground, but they give us some insight into some of the tensions and differences between those groups. So they, on some points, they seem to have had similar shared ideas with the Pharisees. Like, they all seem to, as far as we read in the scrolls and the New Testament, that there was a belief in resurrection. Okay, well, they had some agreement there. Well, but then they also had things they agreed on with Sadducees, apparently, like water impurity and their views of certain types of impurity. That's where that common Judaism is that comes from. Like they have a lot of shared ideas, then they have some differences. Where the scrolls community seems to fit in all that is likely they're an Essene group that's part of some Essene movement. Like we're talking about, not every individual today is going to fit in this political party or that, or this sports team affiliation or that. There's going to be some diversity to those things, right? And being a Pharisee and Sadducee and Essene probably meant here's the broad framework of things that you do and think and live by, but there's some diversity in that. So the Essenes probably had a movement with the Essene community at Qumran being part of a larger movement. And we see this already in Josephus and Philo when they're talking about Essenes. They say, they seem to have done this. Some lived out in the wilderness, but some lived in towns. Some did this, but some did that. And again, not terribly shocking when you think about this as human culture that, you're going to have some diversity. But when we look at the scrolls, there's some really helpful hints. Pliny the historian talks about Essenes living on the near the Dead Sea. He says they only had the company of palm trees, and that's about where we find Qumran. You know, then we have Josephus and Philo talking about their community demographics, their beliefs, their ascetic, you know, qualities on the wilderness. You know, there are things like hierarchical community structures, shared meals, prayer, liturgy. A lot of that stuff sounds like when we read the scrolls, what's going on. So is there a firm conclusion? No. Are they likely Essenes? Probably. So I think even in my chapter, I call them Essene-ish, which is a very modern way of putting it. But it's to try to get us in that balance of this is probably who they were, part of this movement, but we have some fuzzy edges.
And one connection that I've just got to ask about, because 25 years ago, you know, my professor said the connection is tenuous, if there even is a connection. Has the connection between the Essenes, Qumran, and John the Baptist gotten any more solid, or does it remain, there's resemblances, but there's no real connection?
Yeah, I think it's more the latter. There's a resemblance, but there's no real connection. And where would that resemblance come from? Well, guess what? John the Baptist was an ancient Jew around the same time as these folks were. So it would be shocking if they didn't have similarities in the same way that, you know, you and I are thousands of miles apart. We probably have a lot of similarities because we're, you know, in part of a general shared cultural structure in a way, right? You know, to kind of push the analogy.
And, so, and our listeners don't know, you know, this, John, we're both sitting in front of bookshelves.
Yeah, exactly. So we have some things that bind us, much like these books. But yeah, was John in a scene? You know, probably not. Did he have some shared ideas? Sure. The bigger, more interesting question then is, why and where do those things come from? And that's kind of that shared fabric, to get back to Sanders' kind of early work on that common framework.
Very good, very good. In recent years, I've become more and more interested in the history of ritual practices. So your chapter on Qumran archaeology caught my interest on this score. What can we say, and with what kind of confidence, about ritual washing and animal sacrifices in the community that left us the scrolls? And how do these things inform the way we imagine the way this community relates to the Jerusalem temple?
Yes, the scrolls, we talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls because we're talking about manuscripts. But one of the remarkable things about this discovery is they're also associated with an archaeological site, a place called Qumran, on the northwest shore of the Dead Sea, as well as many of the caves had archaeological artifacts, like, you know, artifacts of human culture. And so it's not only manuscripts, there's that context as well. And when we look at things like ritual practices and archaeology, you're right, Nathan, there's some interesting things here and some open questions. So let's think about purity. You know, we can look at that, and then we can look at sacrifice as well. The Qumran, site of Qumran includes many different, you know, structures and buildings, but there's an aqueduct and a water system. You know, part of that's because you're living in the wilderness. You're by the Dead Sea. You need some fresh water. And part of that is for ritual purity, because there are several baths, ritual purity baths, called mikvaot, or mikveh in the singular in Hebrew, at Qumran that are part of this. Now, these pools are for ritual immersion for purity purposes, and there's many throughout the complex. One of them has a large crack down the middle from an earthquake, so you can see, like, this is quite literally, you know, a human experience out in the wilderness. Some of them, like I'm thinking of one, I think it's at Locust 48 and 49, if my memory serves correctly, where there's not only steps going down into it, but some plastic partition would have been a real discovery. A plaster partition going down these stairs. It seems like this is an intentionally designed infrastructure so that you could go down on unclean or impure and then come back up the other side pure. There's a lot of discussion around ritual purity in the Dead Sea Scrolls, but that was a real reorientation in and around like the mid-90s, maybe when you were kind of getting the scrolls a bit. Lawrence Schiffman's book, Reclaiming the Dead Sea Scrolls, put that light bulb on. He said, look, if we're going to understand these texts, we have to understand them as Jewish texts, and that means paying attention to things like purity. So things like that in the archaeological record really open up all sorts of things for ritual practices in that sense, in a very deep and important way for purity. But animal sacrifice, you're right, like, what is going on there? Like, dot, 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 question mark. This is hugely debated, because at Qumran, We know that this was a group that distanced themselves from the Jerusalem temple and that establishment, that they disapproved of the temple worship there. They thought it was illicit, unacceptable, and unclean, and the list goes on. So they removed themselves from it. We also know that they still valued a temple, or the idea of a temple, as having that meaningful kind of relationship between our world and the other world, and how they related to God. So they innovated their liturgy. This group understood their liturgy to be elevating them to the heavens, and we start to have this idea that prayers are kind of a substitute for sacrifice. It's still taking shape, but they're elevating themselves through liturgy rather than going down the highway and offering sacrifice. But we also have a Qumran, I think it's like 492 animal bones that were found in deposits throughout the site. These are apparently of sheep and goats and cattle. Surprise, surprise, these are all the species, or many of the species, that could be used for sacrifice according to Leviticus 1. So that opens the question, were they just barbecuing, or were they sacrificing? What's going on here? And then we go read Josephus, like I think in Antiquities, book 18, he talks about Essenes, and he says some of them even had private rites, maybe like this. I think when we think about the Jerusalem temple, we think that was the only shop in town. It literally was in Jerusalem, but not necessarily elsewhere. You know, Elephantine in Egypt is a Jewish colony. They have a temple. There's likely, with their own cultic rites happening there. Is it that far out of touch to think that the Qumranites were also doing their own sacrifices? Possible. I don't think we really know. I think there's been more work on their understanding as liturgy, as replacing that. Whether or not these are actual animal sacrifices is kind of unknown. But what's interesting to kind of, you know, push beyond Qumran is when the Romans flatten the temple, then there is no temple, and literally every Jewish group and every Jewish community and the early Jesus followers are reorienting their life without a temple already. And the Qumranites were kind of, in a way, ahead of the curve because they were already trying to figure this out. So ritual practices, if that's something you're excited about, something like this is a spot for you, Nathan. So we might get you back into Dead Sea Scrolls research just by highlighting all the ritual stuff. But yeah, those are some great areas to explore for sure.
And to follow up on that, I mean, is there any kind of, genealogical connection between what Qumran is doing and what we eventually see in the Babylonian Talmud about, you know, prayers being sacrifices? Or do those things seem to develop just organically in different places?
I think it's a bit of both, but that's where, you know, when I was saying earlier about like prayer as sacrifice is starting to percolate, like it's coming together. Like it's not, I don't think it's like, could be wrong on this. It's maybe been a while since I've read those texts, but it's not fully there. But we really do see this, you know, a few centuries on. So that's one of the interesting things about Qumran is, you know, we're always looking in the rearview mirror going like, well, what was happening back there? Is there something that helped kind of pave the way for that thought, idea, text, or otherwise? So there'd be some something to explore there, but certainly not as fully developed as far as I'm aware.
Very good. Well, I'm going to pose a question that really aims for folks who have done some formal biblical studies. So listeners, work with me for a moment. When my beloved Greek professor, Bob Hull, may he rest in peace, taught us 23 years ago, he taught us to go with Lectio Difficilior. There we go. I couldn't say it back then either. The textual variant that makes for the most difficulty. So if you've got two manuscripts, one of which makes good sense with modern theology, and the other one that is not nearly as smooth, go with the one that is tough. Now, you say, not so fast. So leave our listeners some reason to go and read your book, because I want our listeners to go read your book. But in broad terms, what is your case against Lectio Difficilior as the default when we look at textual variants?
Yeah, love this question. I'm sure we could have like an entire hour on this, so I'll try to... And I get really excited about it, so I'll try to not push the clock too much on this. I'll start off maybe saying earlier when we were chatting, I highlighted this is a world of scribes. This is a world where texts are still developing. And a footnote to this, like I think it's interesting you mentioned this is a Greek professor. I'm assuming probably like New Testament Greek, if I'm hearing you correctly. Maybe. Yeah. So New Testament text criticism is not the same, you know, kettlefish necessarily as Hebrew Bible Old Testament. So there is that piece there. So I'll nuance that. But when we're in an ancient Jewish scribal culture, and this is at a time and place where scriptures, many writings are still developing, there's just going to be some more fluidity. And now that might be surprising to us as modern readers, because we've been reading the Bible in this form or that form for a very long time. But this is an era of scribes and scrolls and scriptures, not of fixed text necessarily. Now, why I think it's helpful to think differently about those rules is because they might assume some things that don't fit with that. The harder text is always better. That's based on the assumption that a scribe would try to smooth something out, which is not always the case. Another rule is that, longer texts are later, right? That a scribe's more likely to add something than to take something out. Well, not necessarily. So I think all those things, now the opportunity we have is to look at actual manuscripts, learn about their scribal culture, and then go, what are they doing? So I'll maybe pick one example that cuts against the grain a little bit, but still gives us some incredible insights. So the book of Jeremiah, fantastic book. Love the book of Jeremiah, talk about it in this book in many places. And there's some incredible manuscripts in the Dead Sea Scrolls of Jeremiah. I'll pick up on one, 4Q Jeremiah A. I want to say it's 4Q71, but I could be off on my Dead Sea Scroll codes there. This is an interesting manuscript and an incredibly important one for several reasons. First, it's one of the oldest texts in the Dead Sea Scrolls. When we date this text, or when it was dated paleographically, by the handwriting style, although those dates are always a bit rough, it's dated to somewhere between 225 and 175 BCE. That is pretty old. That's one of the older manuscripts on that dating principle in the entire Dead Sea Scrolls library. At the same time, this text, one of our oldest texts in the scrolls and one of our oldest, the oldest text of Jeremiah, has the most errors and scribal innovations in it compared to almost any other text in the scrolls. It has text written down the sides and the margins. It has things in between lines. It has corrections. You could say this is a very messy manuscript. We could also look at this, well, what do the words actually say? This manuscript of Jeremiah is an example of a long version of Jeremiah that we also know about from other Hebrew texts, like the Masoretic text, versus the shorter version in the Septuagint. So all of a sudden, we've gone from one manuscript that's kind of old, kind of messy, to, hold on a second, this actually maps onto the textual history of a longer book, but it's our earliest one. So when I think about those rules, I think back about to when I was starting to learn Hebrew and Greek and Aramaic, and those rules are helpful for learning, but we need to then ask, how do they map onto actual manuscripts? So my points here in this book and even this conversation is that, we're in a world of scrolls. We're in a world of scriptures developing and a world of scribes. There's a lot more dynamism than we are used to there. Their job was to both preserve and pass along text. So it's a both and. Now, every student of, whether it's New Testament Greek or learning Hebrew and Aramaic for the Old Testament, you know that you're taught rules and then you're learning all the exceptions, right? It's harder. That's actually the real hard part, is not learning the rules. It's the hard part is learning the exceptions. Whereas, my approach is to really start with manuscripts and go, can we learn about this culture? And then can we explore how we balance that diversity and this unity? Because not a single rule is going to apply to all the manuscripts the same way. Is it wrong to still teach these rules? No, it's not. Is it an opportunity to try and look at some manuscripts and say, here's where they work really well, and then here's where they don't answer all the questions? So there again, I think you're maybe sensing a theme in these questions. It's a both and. I think the opportunity of the scrolls is now we're mapping that onto actual manuscripts in an actual scribal culture to test and see if that rule works all the time. And simple truth is it doesn't. But this helps us see the ways that it opens up other insights into ancient texts and their contexts.
Well, I want to stick with that question of textual variants, because one of the things that I found fascinating here is that there are different versions of Daniel in this collection. Yeah. So, I mean, as best as we can tell, and if the answer is we just can't tell, I can be satisfied with that. Does this kind of poke holes in the teaching that I receive that, when you've got different versions of a text, they come from different communities? Or, should we posit some sort of Aramaic-speaking Petrarch running around and collecting scrolls from different libraries and bringing them back to Qumran? Are either of those pictures even in the ballpark, or am I getting it entirely wrong?
Well, the scrolls we have, you know, Daniel or Jeremiah or Psalms is a great example of this. Isaiah, multiple manuscripts of these, many of these texts, although there's, you know, you can count and debate them, but we have many texts like this. Many of them, like we were just talking about Jeremiah, you can say the same thing about Psalms. They exist in different, multiple editions. You know, you and I, like we were saying earlier, we both have books in our backgrounds. We might have different editions of the same book, where yours might be the second, mine might be the first, yours might be the eighth, mine might be the sixth. The same book, but in our case, it's publishers trying to make more money. So they add things in and they update it, but it's still the same book, essentially. We have that in the scrolls, and that was, and in the Septuagint, the Greek scriptures as well. So this is something where the scrolls and Septuagint are helping us see something, that the rule was that generally, if a book mattered, it was copied and circulated, and that often meant that it grew and developed into multiple editions. I think that can be so shocking and unsettling to our notions of scripture, because we're in that post-printing press world, where we're used to our expectation of is uniformity, and anything less is false. But that's not the case in an ancient scribal culture. In fact, it's the opposite. The fact that there's so many copies of Psalms traditions and collections of Qumran, Isaiah, Jeremiah, you know, you could have a longer list, Deuteronomies like this. The fact that we have so many copies in different forms and somewhat different shapes and sizes, somewhat sometimes literally, is actually signaling their importance. Because if Jeremiah didn't matter, then there'd be one manuscript. Nobody would have bothered to copy it and circulate it. Like you mentioned earlier before, you're spot on. It's a lot of investment to actually say, you know what, we're going to write another scroll here. That's time, expertise, energy, money. So to have some of the manuscripts we have in so many copies, and again, there's nuance around that, but that is a signal generally to the message of this work mattered. I think we fixate on words on the page. Scribes did too, obviously, they were scribes. But they're also more interested in, well, what about the figure of David behind the Psalms? What about the prophet Jeremiah behind the book of Jeremiah? What about the lawmaker Moses behind the Torah? And these traditions that we experience as texts are more about kind of the orbit of these figures and how those writings are developed and told and retold. So it's that diversity that's actually an important indicator of some of their authority.
Very good. I want to jump up to chapter 8, the one that deals with Aramaic language texts, because one of the conversations that emerges there has to do with the ethics of pseudepigraphal texts in the ancient world. Now, I have read accounts of these texts attributed to much earlier authors, that have ranged from Bart Ehrman's book Forged, which contends, I mean, pretty flagrantly that, you know, any kind of pseudepigraphy should diminish the moral standing of a given text. If you think of that as one extreme, the other extreme might be everybody knew that everybody was doing it, nobody cared. And I imagine that, you know, there's all kinds of variations in between those two extremes. As far as you can tell, what were Qumran's readers and auditors thinking when they heard a scroll read and they attributed that scroll to Enoch?
Yeah, great question and great example that, like, Enoch is kind of the... I was reading this earlier this week, and, you know, Enoch, and he gets some really quick airplay in the book of Genesis, right? You know, Enoch was, you know, part of a genealogy, and then he walks with God and God takes him away. Yet he becomes this, like, Aramaic apocalyptic rock star with all of these books written in his name and attributed to him. They were hugely important at Qumran, but they also have, you know, reception history, not least into Ethiopian Orthodox Christianity. But at Qumran, there are several copies of different booklets of Aramaic Enoch, except for the Book of Parables, if I'm not mistaken, but many other writings of Enoch that are starting to come together that eventually we call First Enoch. So I said a minute ago about figures more than it is about text in some cases. So the figure of Enoch and these traditions had a really pervasive influence on the thought of this group, the Qumranites, on things like the origins of evil, on things like demonology. It seems like a lot of these ideas that they have in their outlook and expectations have an Enochic kind of thread to them at times. So that shows the influence here. Now, do I think that the Qumranites were going, well, we think Enoch's a forgery and or we don't care? highly unlikely, most likely somewhere in the middle, right? Like they're aware that this tradition matters because it's coming from something they inherited and they're extending. Now, that word to me is very important, that extending a tradition piece, because what I'm most interested in is less the question of, you know, how did people think about pseudepigraphy? I don't think you'll ever know that, frankly. What we can ask is how was the mechanism of pseudepigraphy used to extend traditions? So I'm less interested in are they pretending and more in how are they extending. And let me give you a few examples, because in Genesis Apocryphon, that Aramaic text in Cave 1 we were talking about, this is a great read. Like, you got to go read the Genesis Apocryphon. It's just really cool stuff. There's a scene in that that's retelling the tale of Abram and Sarai going down into Egypt in Genesis 12. And there's a part that is in the Aramaic Genesis Apocryphon that this tradition includes. Abram is reading from a book of Enoch before some Egyptian nobility. Now, this is a nice little take on this in this remake of Genesis. But if you pay attention to what's going on there, I think this is making a critique that's saying, look, Abram's already kind of our guy. By the way, he has this conduit of knowledge from Enoch, from before the flood. And you know what? The Egyptians think they're so smart. They got all this stuff from us anyways, because they just learned it all from Abram via Enoch. So it's this cultural critique where it's saying, you know, we have our ancestral forefather, Abram, our pre-flood forefather, Enoch, and there's this literature that's developed in and around those authoritative figures that then extends their tradition, like in this case, the Genesis Apocryphon. There are several scrolls that do this. We see this in the Hebrew Bible. We see this in the New Testament. But the scrolls really helped us illumine the mechanics of how pseudepigraphy could work, from a title to using a first-person voice, to putting a book within a narrative like that one, to having cameos of a more famous figure showing up all of a sudden. Those are the types of things that we see happening in the scrolls that, again, less about, you know, what did people think and why a scribe would do it, and more about how they did it and then what it helped them do to extend that tradition. Because again, if a tradition matters, you don't leave it in the past. You bring it forward, and pseudepigraphy was one of the ways they were doing that by some of those mechanisms.
That's fascinating. And on an entirely silly level, it reminds me of the Old English Exodus poem. I don't know if you've ever encountered that one.
Tell me.
I mean, among other things, I mean, there's all kinds of wonderful things that go on in this poem. But one of the things is when Moses goes off to the Red Sea and leaves the Hebrews there, you know, as the Egyptian army is advancing, the Hebrews all get out their chainmail and put on their chainmail and form up a shield wall, and they're about to fight the Egyptians. And Moses has to come back and say, no, we're not going to fight them. We're going to cross this Red Sea.
But this is, I've got to read this, but we described there, this is not unlike what ancient scribes are doing. They're looking for, they were a perceived gap in the text and going, well, what happened there? And can we explain it or imagine what might have been? And that's a great example of, you know, that even in a poem closer to your own day.
Oh, sure. Now, this podcast is Christian Humanist Profiles, so I do want to spend a bit of time here at the end on questions that the scrolls raise about Christos or Mashiach or other terms that involve anointing. So I remember learning 25 years ago that the Dead Sea Scrolls complicate the question of Messiah, that some of the scrolls present a royal Messiah and a priestly Messiah, and that some of the scrolls presume that these will be, you know, distinct historical figures happening either in, you know, a moment together or in consecutive moments. But your examination goes beyond that. So take a moment to tell us about the plurality of Messiah notions that seem to have obtained in the Qumran era.
Yeah, happy to. This is an area where the scrolls helped us add and expand our understanding of what ancient messianism looked like, because it really expanded our view of different models, if you will, of what messianic hopes were like. Obviously, you know, like you said, it's a Christian Humanist podcast, and many of us are familiar with messianism only because of the Christian New Testament. You know, Christ was not Jesus's last name. It means Messiah. So it just so happens we're most familiar with that version of Messiah. But the scrolls help us see that in ancient Judaism, there was some diversity of messianic thought. Even before that, Messianic thought was not a defining feature of different Jewish groups, as far as we're aware, at least as far as I would argue. This is why in the New Testament, when you see, you know, Jesus bumping shoulders with other groups, and there's some tension and debates, they're not really debating Messianism. They're debating things like ritual purity, right? Like, so I think Messianism, it can actually get blown out of proportion. So having said that, there's some interesting things here to look at. You know, the scrolls, some texts have, like, the community rule and rule of the congregation in different ways. These are two texts on the same scroll from Cave 1. They have views of maybe like a dual Messiah, you know, a priestly Messiah and a Messiah of David and a Messiah of Aaron. These are some language we hear. So all of a sudden, Messiahs, plural, that already is its own thing. Different Messianic actors and agents is part of at least one version way of thinking about this. Then we have another text. We're just talking about Aramaic texts. Another text in Aramaic, 4Q246, is often called the Son of God text. Well, I bet you can guess why. It's because this text refers to a figure as the Son of God, and it refers to him as the Great, and has some other divine names there that are quite familiar to us, particularly if you're familiar with Luke chapter 1, because this is where Luke uses those names in the same, roughly the same application to Jesus as being the Son of God and calling him a few other divine names, or in the context of other divine names, rather. There we can see is, okay, we could ask, is Luke borrowing from 4Q246? Well, no, this is a good example of where some of the Messianic thinking, perhaps, and that idea, the ideas are circulating, Luke or his sources are part of that world. So he's engaging in that conversation, which is interesting. Another example like that is a Hebrew text called 4Q521. This is a text that a part of it has to do with kind of some of the signs of the Messianic times, if you will. Less about who the Messiah is, but how you'll know, you know, what things are going to happen kind of around the time that he's here. And that text interprets passages from the Psalms and Isaiah, and it talks about things like healing will be happening, sight will be restored, there'll be good news being preached, and then it adds the dead will be raised. Now, I bet as soon as I say that list of things, listeners are going, well, that sounds familiar. It's because it does, from the Gospels, right? Like, I'll pick on Luke again. I actually like Luke. Shouldn't say pick on. I'll reference Luke again. You know, Luke 7 is one of the places where this happens, where John the Baptist is on death row, and he sends a disciple to ask Jesus, "Are you the guy?" And Jesus answers back with a very similar list there. Oddly similar, eerily similar. What's interesting about that is that part about resurrection is not found in Psalms or Isaiah in those passages. So where is 4Q521 getting this? Where is Luke getting this? Shocker. Again, this is part of that broader framework. They don't have to know each other or be borrowing from each other or copying from each other. They can be conversing with a shared context. So when we look at things like Messianism, there's some incredible insights to go, oh, this is some of the kind of broader framework for how some Jewish groups or the Qumran group was thinking about Messianic expectations. Were they the defining feature? No, they weren't. But are there important elements of that they provide for understanding the context of New Testament Messianism? Absolutely. So in the later in the book, yeah, chapter 8 or 9, as you mentioned, it's asking those questions, with this being one of them. What do the scrolls do or don't they do for us when we're trying to think about Christian origins? And this would be an example of that kind of conceptual world that they plug us into.
I want to follow up on that because Dom Crossan has been on the show a couple times, so I tend to think of New Testament Messianic language as very much entangled with imperial rhetoric and Caesar mm-hmm. rhetoric. It seems like the Dead Sea Scrolls, I mean, mention the Kittim. I do remember that from 25 years ago. But yeah, doesn't seem to take aim at Rome nearly as often as it takes aim at the Herodian kings or the Hasmonean Jerusalem priests. Does that carry through in this Messianic language, or is this Messianic language still making reference to the rhetoric that they would have heard from specifically Roman agents?
Yeah, great question. I think we're seeing, like, the scrolls are part of, I don't know if it's, you know, rebalancing or like pendulum swinging or whatever the metaphor is here. You know, and I think there's been a recognition that New Testament, Dead Sea Scrolls, these are all writings that are deeply shaped and embedded within. They're part of an imperial context. So it'd be shocking if there's nothing about empire in them. It's on every page, whether you see it or not, because this is an imperial context. So full stop, you know. And this is also a context that has a deep history and heritage of ideas inherited from Jewish scribal cultures, which are connected to Babylonian scribal cultures. There's a whole lot of other avenues that are flowing into the intellectual world at this point in time. I think what the scrolls can do for us in terms of messianism is actually help rebalance that a little bit. Not every messianic term or language was speaking against the empire, I don't think. I think that they show us there are other competing models, but there are other ways also of thinking about Messiah that some of these texts, like Luke and things like 5:21 and 2:46, are directly relevant to that. Does that mean that we've been wrong to read things as speaking into and against an imperial context? No, because they're in an imperial context. It would be odd, again, if they weren't. But have we heard everything that we think they might be getting at when they use a term like Son of God? What that 4Q 2:46 text does for us is, I think it shows us that this was a term that was in the register, the linguistic register, even, if you will, of ancient Jews. Not necessarily that the New Testament had to get this idea from imperial theology, for example. So I think it can help nuance and balance. Like most things, I don't think it's an either or. I think it's a value add. But I do think here that the messianic models of the scrolls do help us provide maybe a different context than we were used to in our previous interpretations.
Very good. Well, Andrew, I've been at the wheel for most of this conversation. So in the spirit of hospitality, I'm going to let you have the last word. What do you want our listeners thinking about the Dead Sea Scrolls, biblical studies, Hobby Lobby, or anything else as we head for the door?
First, it's been great to be here. You've already given me a lot to think about, too, and a poem to read, and at least one thing to think about Shakespearean code names. So you've given me not just some time and good conversation, but some takeaways for myself. Anything to kind of leave listeners with. Approaching the scrolls, stay curious. Be open. In my experience, these texts have been an incredible space to explore and to think and to read around and before the Bible and all these things. You know, when you read my book, it's rooted in a question, and I get at this in the first preface chapter, you know, that this book is all about asking, how do the scrolls challenge, change, or confirm what we think about the Bible and its world and its text and all these things? But those three verbs, challenge, change, or confirm, the scrolls do all three. They do confirm a lot of things that we thought we already knew. They also force us to go do we need to change some things that we think we had, or do we have it all right or not really? And they challenge things. Did we really get that right, or do we need to rethink it? There's an opportunity here to do all three. I think any treatment of the scrolls that says this overturns the Bible entirely or proves the Bible entirely is not being honest with you. So I'm trying to be authentic in my writing here and say, look, it's all of these things. So let's get into it together. Let's do it in a way that's accessible and meaningful. Be curious, stay open. And I would also say, alongside of reading this book, we're in a remarkable time right now of digital access to images. You know, look up the scrolls online. Like if you Google the Leon Levy Digital Dead Sea Scrolls Library, within three clicks, you can be seeing almost all of the Dead Sea Scrolls in very high resolution images that you can't even see most of those manuscripts if you go to a museum today in Jerusalem. And it's free, and you can do it from your couch, your office, your living room, wherever. Material objects really change the way we think. Even if you can't read Hebrew, Aramaic, or Greek, spend some time just looking at these things. And when you're reading about them, this is kind of like giving your brain some props to be imagining what we're actually talking about. So dive in, be open, be challenged, change, and look out for the things that they confirm, and explore the scrolls on your own. And I hope this is a great book to invite you into that space and that opportunity.
Andrew Perrin, thank you for coming on Christian Humanist Profiles.
Thanks so much for having me.
Listeners, thank you for downloading and listening in. The book is Lost Worlds and Forgotten Words from Lexham Academic Press. Christian Humanist Profiles is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our audio editor is Britt Stack. And I'm Nathan Gilmore saying, go in grace, go in peace, serve the Lord.